Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news.
We'll begin with the grave situation in Ukraine that appears to be on the brink of civil war, in spite of President Yanukovych's announcement of a truce with the opposition. Anders Aslan, the co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics and a former Swedish diplomat and economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine, joins us to discuss the opposition takeover of police stations and the surrender of security forces to the opposition as the European Union discusses sanctions and Russian President Putin warns against Western interference. Then we'll go to Toluca, Mexico, to speak with Tim Johnson, the Mexico City bureau chief for McClatchy Newspapers, who is covering the so-called Three Amigos North American Summit, where President Obama is meeting with Mexican President Peña Nieto and Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper to discuss trade, immigration, energy, and other issues. We will discuss what the Mexican and American leaders, who are more popular abroad than they are at home, can come to an agreement on, and whether Prime Minister Harper has succeeded in pressuring President Obama to agree to the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. Then finally, we will speak with Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of the new book, Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. We will discuss his groundbreaking analysis of how politicians and plutocrats use veiled racist appeals to persuade white voters to support policies that favor the extremely rich while threatening the real interests of middle class and working Americans. We will also examine the extent to which identity politics on the left play into the hands of these reactionary politicians and plutocrats.
And joining us now is Anders Aslan, who's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, served as an economic advisor to the government of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine, and he is the author of How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Aslan.
Thank you very much.
And we're just learning now that President Viktor Yanukovych has sacked the army chief and replaced him with the head of the Ukrainian Navy. Would that indicate that the army chief perhaps didn't want to go as far as Yanukovych wanted him to go in cracking down on protesters?
Yeah, and this was not the first change in the military command. The Minister of Defense, who's originally Russian, has said repeatedly that the military will stay out of a civil conflict in Ukraine, and that its only task is to defend Ukraine's national integrity. So I presume that this is a step in that direction, and the military today made a statement, that is the Minister of Defense, that it could get engaged in anti-terrorist actions, and that is what President Yanukovych now calls his crackdown on the opposition.
So is this, do you think, being implemented to the urging of Putin? I mean, he's basically been, his attitude seems to have been that Yanukovych has to get tough. And of course, he blames this all on Western interference. But is that Yanukovych doing this on his own, or is Putin giving him the kind of backbone to crack down?
Yeah, I think that's the right way of putting it, that President Putin is giving him the backbone to crack down. They did meet on the 6th and 7th of February in Sochi. The expectation before and after was that President Putin had told President Yanukovych that now you had better crack down. And this is exactly what we are seeing. And it was even said President Putin does not mind if this crackdown happens before the Sochi Winter Olympics are still going on. And that's indeed what has happened.
So what does this mean, though, in terms of my understanding was that the army and the armed forces were politically neutral and I suppose, to put it in a facile way, patriotic, and that Yanukovych relied on his sort of cadre of stormtroopers, the palace guard, if you will, and they only number about 7,000, I believe. So if he starts employing the full military, are they reliable?
Hardly. That has been one reason why the military have not been called in before. And a broad assumption previously has been that the military would stay out and that the police would go with the local authorities. That is, in the western half would go to the opposition and the eastern half of the police to the Yanukovych. And that seems to be right. It's highly doubtful that the military can really be used.
Well, there are apparently already reports and video from the western Ukrainian city of Lviv, where soldiers have surrendered to protesters.
Indeed, and this is what you would expect in the western part of Ukraine. But Lviv, Ivano-Frankivsk, and Ternopil, that's 3 out of 25 regions where... you can say Soviet power was never really respected. In these parts of Ukraine, it took 10 years for the Red Army to get control over the guerrilla after the Second World War. So this part of the country is rather special.
And also, I believe, in this part of the country, there have been attacks on police stations as well.
Indeed. It seems that in about half the country... opposition forces have either attacked the police headquarters or taken them over. And the same is true of security services.
So the meeting then that took place between the opposition leaders, the boxer Vitaly Klitschko and Yatsenyuk, they met with President Yukanovich late on Tuesday night, but they failed to come to an agreement. Any indication of what was discussed and why the agreement was not reached?
Well, what Vitaly Klitschko has said is that the only way of solving the conflict now is early parliamentary and presidential elections. What they previously has discussed has been a coalition government or a technical government, but Yanukovych has said no to that and wants to have his own prime minister who should be appointed this week. And the other issue has been to go back to the more balanced constitution that Yanukovych had abolished in a very dubious fashion. And then instead, President Yanukovych sends in the storm troops. So what conversation can you have with such a person? The attitude of the opposition now is clearly that the only thing one can really discuss with President Yanukovych, that is how he will go and how early elections can be organized.
But of course, he is saying, I was a duly elected president, and that is what the Russians are saying. And
that yeah, but a duly elected president is not supposed to steal something like $10 billion, which is what Yanukovych and his family has straightforward stolen from the Ukrainian government, nor is the president supposed to steal a parliamentary election, which is what happened in October 2010.
And what would that theft of from this kleptocratic family, largely led by the president's eldest son, who's a former dentist, who apparently is the one that shakes down the billionaires and basically says, I'm your new partner. What percentage do you think of the country's GDP has this family stolen?
Well, the assessment that is made of how much the family has made is... $12 billion, which is the rumored number, which is, of course, very approximate, but it tells you something about the size. And the GDP of Ukraine is $180 billion. So that leaves 6-7% of the GDP in the hands of the Yanukovych family.
And I take it that this is a subtext of much of the disgust amongst the members of the opposition and you know, they've been, you have to admit that they have really been persistent and they're showing up in the worst weather in the Maidan, the big square. They've been unyielding, have they not? Something is clearly holding. There's some real glue there, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, in particular that last night, that these thousands of stormtroopers could not take the the Maidan. And in the end, 10,000 protesters were still there. But what has happened with the Maidan is that it has become quite militarized. So it's a rather scary place now. And of course, last night, the center of Kiev looked very much like a battlefield, as it indeed was.
So to what extent are these, they're called Tatushki, are they, the government thugs?
Yeah.
Are they the ones that are militarizing the situation, or is it? Is there, obviously there's some reciprocity there?
Well, it's a reciprocity. So Maidan is quite militarily organized in itself. It's organized in battalions. The protesters have put on helmets and bulletproof vests to the extent that they have it. So while so far they have gone with baseball bats, they have thrown stones, and they have not used firearms. Neither side used firearms last night. Even so, 26 people were killed. And next time it would be natural that firearms are being used by both sides. And then we could see a real civil war. This is a frightful situation in Ukraine.
And do you think that Yanukovych understands that, or more importantly, does Putin understand that?
I think that for President Putin, this would mean that Ukraine's attempt to go to towards Europe has ended in tragedy, and that shows that this is something that nobody should do. For President Yanukovych, I think that he's just interested in salvaging himself, not his nation.
Well, but if Putin were to make that justification that this is what democracy brings, chaos and death, that's an assumption that he's going to win, that his side's going to win. Is that your feeling?
It's not my feeling, but my fear is that this will be very bloody at this stage. My only hope is that so many on Yanukovych's side will say that you can't do this. Something has to be done to stop it. And indeed, this morning, President Yanukovych said that it makes no sense to talk to the opposition. They have to give up and be peaceful first. And in the evening, he appointed a commission under his chief of staff, Andriy Kluyev, which is supposed to negotiate with the opposition. So he did turn around during the day, but that is not enough.
Well, we know from that conversation that was leaked clearly by the Russians with the U.S. State Department official and the U.S. ambassador castigating the Europeans for being feckless, I guess, in terms of their support for the Ukrainian opposition. There has been meetings with Klitschko, the opposition leader, the boxer, with Angela Merkel. What's your sense of obviously the Russians are blaming the Europeans for meddling and the Americans for meddling. Is there, how resolute do you think the West are in supporting the opposition?
What it appears today is that the European Union is much more resolute than the United States. The Minister for Foreign Affairs of the European Union met today, and they are preparing personal sanctions against the people most responsible in Ukraine. They did not mention names. The U.S. has clarified that certain people are not allowed visas into the United States, but in either case, the names have been given. It seems right now as if Europe is taking the lead and the U.S. is rather lagging behind.
And what would explain that? Does the U.S. simply not want to confront Putin?
The U.S. has more different interests with Russia. For example, Iran and for some reason Syria is considered to be something that the U.S. should cooperate with Russia on. For Europe, Ukraine is really important.
Well, but the U.S. has been had by the Russians and the Syrians. Kerry has admitted as much.
Yes, indeed. I think so. So too. But if you look up on Iran, the U.S. has a far greater engagement in the Iranian issue than Europe has. Sure. For Europe, Ukraine is far more important than Iran. For the U.S., it's rather the opposite order of priorities.
Well, since Putin is clearly, I think, the main player here, and he's, as we mentioned earlier, giving Yanukovych backbone, I don't think he has much respect for Yanukovych. But why is it then that we treat Putin with respect? I mean, essentially, to my understanding, having spoken to a lot of Russian experts and people that have been persecuted by Putin, obviously they may not be the most objective, but I think if you saw the 60 Minutes piece on Sunday about the Russian lawyer who was murdered in prison,
Magnitsky,
it's pretty clear, I think, that this is a gangster regime and that he's the sort of capo di capo, and that's who he is. And my understanding of gangsters is that at the end of the day, gangsters always crave respect. So why give him respect?
Indeed, I think that you're perfectly right that the best results with President Putin are accomplished when one stands up against him. And indeed, the one recent result President Obama has had with President Putin is after he publicly insulted President Putin at a press conference in August, and before that had said that he was not going to Moscow for bilateral summit with President Putin. Then President Putin came up with this chemical disarmament proposal for Syria. It was entirely because the U.S., as a change, stood up against President Putin. Of course, that's what should be done again.
But it's not necessarily what is being done.
Indeed. I think the wrong policy, a far too soft policy, is being pursued by the U.S. with regard to Ukraine, and it can turn out to be very costly indeed.
Well, Anders Aslan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Anders Aslan, who's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine, and is the author of How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and Democracy.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and go to Toluca, Mexico, for an update on the Three Amigos North American Summit. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Tim Johnson, who is the Mexico City Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers. He worked for 14 years for the Miami Herald, covering U.S. policy towards Latin America, serving as a foreign correspondent for the Herald through most of the 1990s in Central America and the Andean region. And he joins us from the North American Summit meeting of the presidents of Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. in Toluca, Mexico. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tim Johnson.
Thank you, Ian.
And how is the Three Amigos Summit going so far?
Well, it's been interesting because President Obama, is almost as soon as he got here to Mexico, ended up making a statement about the Ukraine. And so, in some ways it was symbolic of the fact that the events surrounding the North American Free Trade Agreement, and which is the largest trading bloc in the world, are easily overshadowed by events elsewhere.
Well, indeed, on today's program, Tim, we just spoke with a former Swedish diplomat whose extensive connections with Ukraine, and he was very pessimistic. Apparently, it's a really grave situation. It's on the brink of civil war. So,
well, I'm certain it's bad, but I guess as I consider why this North American block doesn't get more attention, it's a sign that that North America, in some ways, dreams of integration, of economic and social integration, are really on autopilot. If you look at trade figures, I mean, I hate to divert the conversation here, but trade figures between the U.S. and the Ukraine on an annual basis come to $2.9 billion. The United States and Mexico trade that every 2 days. So, Ukraine is important, but Mexico and Canada combined with the U.S. are really, really important to listeners in the United States, I think.
Well, I think your point's well taken, Tim Johnson, and it underlies the possibility that this summit of the Three Amigos is going to be all talk. Is that the implication, that they're not going to come to any real agreements?
Well, it certainly is the impression that one has here, and it's partly because there's been a process of deceleration of this trade pact. The NAFTA is now 20 years old, and these summits between the leaders are happening less frequently. They met in 2012 and before that 2009, and part of the reason is because there are bilateral spats between several of the members. So the Mexicans are quite irritated at Canada over the issue of hurdles they say are needed for Mexicans to get visas. The process, according to Mexican diplomats, for a Mexican to get a Canadian visa is 10 times harder than to get a U.S. visa. And so Mexican tourism to Canada has dropped in half over the last 5 years. And at the same time, the Canadians are very irritated with the United States over what they see as an imperative for their foreign policy, and that is to build this Keystone XL oil pipeline from Alberta to the U.S. Gulf Coast. As one person I spoke to in Ottawa said, Stephen Harper, the Canadian Prime Minister, has really sort of pinned his hopes on this to make Canada an energy superpower by getting this pipeline built. And, of course, as we all know, there's a lot of opposition to this, especially among more progressive sectors of the Democratic Party in the United States.
So what's your sense, then, of whether Stephen Harper was able to take advantage of this summit to really pressure Obama? I mean, presumably there's a lot of discussions been going on, but that's the expectation, isn't it, that he's really twisting his arm?
Well, I really don't know what's happened in the last hour or two as they've been together, but I can say that I'm not sure Harper has a lot of leverage in this. I don't think President Obama is really ready to make a decision on this until, other factors come into play. So I think there's a lot of frustration on the part of the Canadians that they really haven't been able to make, get either a green light or red light on the project.
And I think you're alluding to the November elections, right?
Well, sure.
Nothing's going to be decided until after then, right?
Yeah, I think that's very possible. And there's also these summits, as I said, they're coming less and less frequently, also illustrate how on a political level there's just not as much engagement as there is on an economic level. So that Canada, say, it's got 2,600 companies who either have operations or offices in Mexico, and the number of U.S. companies is just really extraordinary. I mean, they're doing $1 million worth of trade a minute on that border. A million people cross that border a day. And this isn't just straight, goods manufactured in Mexico going to the U.S. or vice versa, because the supply chains are so integrated now, like it or not, that an average components for an average car cross the border 8 times before the car is actually assembled. And that's either going to Canada or coming back or going to Mexico, because the automotive industry is linked between the three countries in a very integrated way.
So one of the bilateral issues on the agenda apparently between Mexico and the United States sounds like it's something that they could solve, given so far we haven't come up with anything much that's going to be yielded from this summit. What about the monarch butterflies? You know, the Mexican farmers are using a harmful pesticide that are killing them off, and presumably that's something that can be done and achieved, surely.
It may be, although I must say that there is a final statement from the summit that will be publicly released in a few hours. It doesn't even mention the monarch butterfly. So, you know, I mean, it's got very little of substance in there. You know, one of the few areas of agreement is that the three countries have decided to harmonize what they call a trusted traveler program so that travelers who go through a pre-screening process and pay a little bit of money can pass more quickly across the border. But I'm afraid the poor monarch butterfly is not been considered in this summit.
So, Tim Johnson, then, is this then a lot of window dressing because these two leaders, particularly the Mexican and American leaders, apparently are considerably, according to recent polls, are considerably more popular abroad than they are at home?
Well, I think it's a sign that they're not willing to spend a lot of political capital on what it would take to really resolve some of the deeper issues that would bring about greater integration in the region. You know, I mean, it's outside factors that are driving this relationship. Trade, because of NAFTA, has gone up, you know, something like sixfold in the last 20 years. But a lot of that has occurred for other reasons. And you know, they're talking about the North American energy revolution and the colossus and how the epicenter of the global oil industry is moving sort of inexorably towards North America. But that's not occurring because of anything the political leadership has done. It's just factors, you know, outside of politics.
Well, that's not to say that the president doesn't take credit for U.S.'s energy independence and for pushing the natural gas and oil fracking, which apparently is, he's touted that we're spending less now on buying foreign oil than we have in decades.
Yes, he's certainly taking credit for it. It's just that from my perspective here, I don't really see a concerted effort by the three countries to grapple with issues that would really make any sort of a unified kind of market. You know, each one is taking independent action. Mexico is, of course, passed an energy reform here that would open up energy markets to outside investment, which has been radical given Mexico's history. But at the same time, it's yet to be seen how that will unfold in terms of a stronger North American market.
So, Tim Johnson, what about the drug issue, which perennially comes up between the U.S. and Mexico? Is there anything happening on that front? I've been hearing rumors, and they are rumors, that there's a lot of covert activity going on in terms of dealing with drug cartels, that maybe the U.S. Joint Special Operations Command and others are now more deeply involved in Mexico than the DEA has been for some time.
Well, what I can say on that front is this, that in the run-up to the summit on Monday and over the weekend and Monday, there were joint naval federal police operations in Culiacan, the capital of Sinaloa State, which is the headquarters of the most powerful criminal organization in Mexico, the Sinaloa Cartel. And the read on that was that basically President Peña Nieto had intelligence that the forces could locate Ismael Zambada, who's the number two leader of the Sinaloa Cartel. And nothing would have made Peña Nieto happier than to catch a major crime figure like that in the run-up to the summit. It didn't happen, and yet I think it's a sign that the U.S. and Mexico continue deep cooperation, because I don't think this would have happened without a lot of U.S. help.
So the other issue then, along with immigration and energy and drugs, has been trade, and you mentioned NAFTA. And that's somewhat being eclipsed by the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, that Mexico has been involved in. But somebody in that group of Pacific Rim countries is leaking profusely almost every chapter of the agreement as it is hashed out in these secret meetings, seems to end up on WikiLeaks. And it's completely undercut Obama, and I think it's caused tremendous friction with the with the Congress, and Harry Reid is not really going to push it, and neither is Nancy Pelosi. So how's the president going to push the TPP when his own party back home are more than lukewarm on it?
Well, he's going to do it by himself, apparently. He got on the Air Force One this morning and signed an executive order taking steps to accelerate the reporting requirements for exporters and importers of goods. And so that, you know, he's saying, look, I will not cede ground to the Harry Reids and Nancy Pelosi's who are, you know, throwing up roadblocks to freer trade. The White House will take action on its own. So that was rather interesting because he actually signed it in the conference room aboard Air Force One, and they let news agency photographers come in and snap pictures of it. And this was all very unusual. So it's a sign that he's, you know, he wants to do something on his own about free trade, whether the party will go along as a whole. Also on that point, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, as you say, is really the new goal, and both Canada and Mexico realize it. There's going to be no rejiggering of NAFTA as we see it. It's all oriented towards the TPP.
Which is in many ways oriented against China, since China is conspicuously absent.
Yes, it certainly could be seen that way. I don't know the nitty-gritty details of what's being negotiated, although, as you say, a lot of it's being leaked. It's just both Canada and Mexico are on that ship. They're headed, in that direction.
So then what about the thorny issue of immigration? There are 11 million Mexican immigrants undocumented here in the United States. And clearly, there have been some indications that maybe the Democrats and the Republicans could come to some kind of an agreement. But every time the Republicans sort of inch towards it, the Tea Party makes noises and the leadership backs off. So
yeah.
What's your sense of what they discussed in those terms?
Well, there's been nothing in the public statement about immigration that was noteworthy. This is also an issue of huge importance to the Mexicans, and they're very concerned about a continued policy by the Border Patrol, say, to shoot and kill migrants who supposedly are rock throwers. You may have seen that yesterday morning at the Otay Mesa, near the Otay Mesa border crossing there, it's between San Diego and Tijuana, Border Patrol agent shot and killed another Mexican. This makes it more than 21, if I'm not mistaken, who have been shot and killed since 2010. And the Mexican Foreign Secretariat is really, you know, deeply concerned about this. On a number of fronts, the Mexicans want action on immigration and don't quite know how to get Capitol Hill to act. They feel like their hands are tied.
But specifically, these shootings that you mentioned, the rocks are thrown from Mexico and the bullets are fired from the U.S. into Mexico that kill Mexicans. Is that the situation?
Well, it's certainly been the situation for – there was a 16-year-old boy in Nogales, and I'm sorry, I can't come up with a date right now. I think it was in 2012, and he was shot through the border fence by a Border Patrol agent and shot in the back and killed. In other cases, like the one yesterday, the Border Patrol statement said that the agent was hit in the face with a rock. What the size of the rock was is not clear, but he apparently wasn't hit hard enough so that he couldn't pull out his weapon and fire repeatedly at the migrant and killed him. And there's no other corroborating witnesses in this. So
on this side of the border or on the other side of the border?
No, it was at least 10 miles from the border in the U.S. territory.
Oh, in U.S. territory, I see.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it's some of the rock throwers have allegedly been, you know, tossing rocks across the border. And the version that one often hears from law enforcement is that rock throwing is a diversionary tactic used to aid drug smugglers, but in some cases, it's clearly the allegations by the Federal Border Patrol, you know, have wilted in the face of evidence either from video cameras or other testimony. So there's a lot of, it's part of the reason that Mexico is quite unhappy with this.
Well, finally, Tim, I'm grateful that you were able to go through the full agenda here of what the three presidents, the three amigos, are discussing in Toluca, Mexico. But clearly these leaks from Edward Snowden that the National Security Agency had spied on Peña Nieto before he was elected, and they also had access to the former president, Felipe Calderon's email when he was in office. Any word on what was discussed behind the scenes about that?
No, you know, I'll tell you that publicly the Mexican officials, specifically the Foreign Secretary Jose Antonio Meade, they've downplayed this. They said they've gotten explanations from the U.S., and they seem to squirm at any question about this. They really do not want to talk about it. Only the former President Calderon has voiced unhappiness and disgust, really, with it. Otherwise, the sitting Mexican officials, they really don't want to talk about it.
Well, Tim Johnson, I thank you so much for joining us, and I appreciate it.
Ian, it's a pleasure, as always.
Again, I've been speaking with Tim Johnson, who is the Mexico City Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers. He worked for 14 years for the Miami Herald, covering U.S. policy towards Latin America, serving as a foreign correspondent for the Herald through most of the 1990s in Central America and the Andean region. And he joined us from the North American Summit meeting of the presidents of Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. in Toluca, Mexico. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about dog whistle politics, how coded racial appeals have reinvented racism and wrecked the middle class.
Your mind. Politic needs human beings. Politic needs lies. That's
why you've been born with white skin, they explain, and the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame, and the poor white remains on the caboose of the train. But it ain't him to blame, he's only a pawn in their game.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ian Haney-Lopez, who is a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity. Since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law, he remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America. A former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools, his latest book just out is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Haney-Lopez.
Thanks very much. Glad to be joining you.
And your book is, I think, is one of the most important books that I've read for some time. And I've sort of tried to, over the years, to get my hands around the emerging American plutocracy to the point where I was using the word oligarchy to the point that listeners were complaining about it. But now it appears to be very much in the zeitgeist, I think, and people are starting to and perhaps we can thank the Occupy movement for the framing the 99% versus the 1%. But what you're bringing to the table here is, in effect, how our politics are serving the ends of both of politicians and of plutocrats who use veiled racist appeals to persuade white voters to support policies that favor the extremely rich while threatening the real interests of middle class and working Americans.
That's right. So I'm trying to explain how we came to a situation in which we have levels of wealth inequality we haven't seen in 100 years. Or another way to ask that question is, how is it that we have been systematically dismantling the advances of New Deal liberalism over the last 50 years? And one important answer is that conservatives have been using race to convince many white voters that the biggest enemy in their life is not concentrated wealth, but is instead government, and in particular the federal government and its social welfare programs.
And I take it that this movement, if you will, started with Ronald Reagan in his 1980 campaign. And I recall that he sort of ran on the ticket that we need to take
the handcuffs off the millionaires and put the handcuffs on the welfare queens. And he talked about Cadillac driving welfare queens and strapping young bucks buying T-bone steaks with food stamps.
That's exactly right. And if you think about the story he's telling, there are, you know, the one really striking character, the one that hits most people is this image of a welfare queen or a young buck buying a T-bone steak. It's a stereotypical, really ugly myth of blacks who prefer welfare to work and who refuse to take responsibility, but instead are getting over on the rest of society by ripping off government programs. And I think a lot of people have picked up on that and said, hey, you know, this is sort of ugly racial provocations. But what they don't see is that there are a couple of other characters in the story, and one is the you that Reagan is addressing, ostensibly voters who are white, middle class, hardworking, decent, these taxpayers. And even more importantly, there is a character of government itself. And in Reagan's story, it's government that is reaching into the pockets of these hardworking taxpayers, this implicitly white, law-abiding, decent middle class, and is taking their hard-earned dollars and it's giving it to these layabout, undeserving minorities. And this is key because what Reagan is doing is he's not just impugning minorities, he's tarnishing, indeed darkening, government itself. He's making government seem to be the biggest threat in people's lives. And when people vote for politicians who promise to cut back on government, they think what they're getting is a restriction on government assistance to minorities. But in fact, what they're getting is a rollback of the New Deal. So an end to progressive taxation, massive tax cuts for the rich, an end to regulation of concentrated capital, instead allowing corporations and industry to take over the regulation of themselves once again, an end to social welfare programs, which help everybody achieve or maintain middle-class status.
But what occurs to me, Ian Haney Lopez, is that the what the Republicans have done, starting with Reagan publicly in terms of their political strategy, what Mitt Romney, the last candidate to run for president, revealed privately in his famous speech to his wealthy backers, where he talked about the 47%, seems to be also along these lines. It really indicates how they think the kind of plutocratic class about the 47%. That they're just a bunch of freeloaders.
You know, it's an interesting question how people think. I have no doubt that Reagan himself was a true believer in a Goldwater anti-New Deal. People should succeed or fail on their own, and if people fail, they somehow deserve their fate. I have no doubt that Reagan was a true believer in that sense. What Mitt Romney believes, I don't really know. Was he more in line with his father, who was a moderate Republican? Was he more in line with the way he governed Massachusetts? Was he instead fully in line with the sorts of class-tinted comments that he gave about the disparaging comments that he gave about the 47%? But what's clear is that these are politicians who are responding to two different audiences. On the one hand, they're responding to the audience that's funding their campaign, the major donors, who do want a story in which, since they're rich, since they're powerful, they can tell themselves that they really do deserve to have free reign and that they do deserve to rule in the name of the rest of us. And then the other audience is the mass audience, the voters. And there, these politicians, Reagan and Romney alike, understand that they can't come to the public and say, "I'm here on the on behalf of the plutocrats. I'm here on behalf of society's sultans, and we think you should shower us with gifts." So instead, they come to voters and say, "I'm here to save you from poor minorities." And that's where we see this sort of racial appeal being harnessed to a project of undoing New Deal liberalism and giving government over again into the hands of the very wealthy.
Well, one of the things that occurs to me, though, Ian Haney Lopez, is that if
the plutocrats and right-wing politicians are keeping racism alive in this way as a way to galvanize the white minority and to feed into their sense of this atavistic idea that, you know, the Aussie and Harriet world that they had that's being taken away from them by these freeloading minorities. And that is how they deal with the sort of demographic time bomb that they're facing. That, to my mind, to some extent, the American left helps that narrative by also keeping racism alive. My sense is that with identity politics, which is in many ways what cripples the left in America.
You know, I'm not sure what to make of the claim that the left is crippled by identity politics. So what do we mean? If we mean that the left pays attention to the role of identity, and in particular not just identity as a source of one's conception of oneself, but identity as placing oneself within the terms of power relationships in society, men over women, white over black, heterosexual over homosexual. I actually think identity politics in that sense is absolutely essential. What we're committed to is a progressive vision of human flourishing in which all people have a chance to become who they want and are not oppressed or restricted in their life choices by these social hierarchies. So I think that that's great. Now, if what we mean by identity politics is an assertion that we should be loyal to our groups without question, then I completely agree with you. Of course, there's no sense that we should simply be loyal to whatever group we happen to belong to without question, without interrogating that group's social position. I wouldn't characterize the left as being engaged in that sort of identity politics. I think rather it's engaged in a politics that says, pay attention to the way in which society is organized along half a dozen very powerful social hierarchies that places people in different relationships to power and privilege.
Well, I guess because I'm here at Pacifica Radio, I live with that kind of, with competing identity politics, and maybe my horizons have been somewhat limited, or at least influenced by that vision. But what I find refreshing about the younger generation, the millennials, is that they are post-racial and post-gender, if you will, and so that means that none of these appeals have any attraction to them.
I wish that that were completely the case. I think we can say of the millennials that they understand that they should aspire to not let their worldviews and their social relations be determined by these social hierarchies. And that's an important advance. But it's also the case, for example, if one looks at how whites voted for Mitt Romney, that the youngest cohort of white voters also voted for Romney in a majority, rather than a majority of young white voters voting for Obama. So it's not quite the case that the younger generation has fully gotten past race or gotten past gender, but it is the case that I think that more than older generations, they aspire to, and they exist in a milieu which is more likely to challenge stereotypical views or latent hostilities.
Well, I certainly don't mean to in any way come across as somebody that doesn't recognize the pain and injustice of racism and who the victims are. I mean, this new movie that's out now, that's up for the Academy Award, 12 Years a Slave. I mean, I noticed that some politicians, you know, in the South were sort of saying, well, you know, how come, you know, African Americans haven't gotten over it? I mean, you know, and to which I can't remember who it was. Maybe it was the Reverend Al Sharpton or somebody replied, well, you know, we were the only group that were brought here and changed. You know, you, the rest of you, I know what happened. The apologist was saying that other ethnic groups came here to the United States and made it. and therefore, how come African Americans didn't make it? And then, of course, the retort was, well, you know, we came in chains. I'm not sure who it was that in both cases, I'm quoting here, I'm not doing a particularly good job of, but that is, you know, there's no question. And look what just happened down in Florida with that case. I mean, fortunately, the ruling was not like it was in the Trayvon Martin case. But when you think about that, the attitude of that white man that shot into that car full of teenagers, and the indignation that he's actually being held for murder or lesser charges, indicates to me that the mentality of racism is alive and well.
I absolutely think so. I think that racism has evolved, and it has evolved in ways that we can celebrate a lessening of racism in many domains. I really think that there is something remarkable about having an African American president who is not only elected but reelected. At the same time, racism still remains pervasive in the sense that these stereotypes are white about blacks, about Latinos, about Muslims now, about Asians, that they're pervasive, that they're widespread, and also in the fundamental sense that our politics continue to be organized around racial appeals. So the Republican Party today is effectively a party that is constituted in terms of appeals to white solidarity. It draws 90% of its support from white voters. Its state elected officials are 98% white. So it's very hard to suggest, or it's unconvincing, it's uncredible to suggest that we are now a post-racial society. And I think that we see eruptions of racism in some dramatic cases, like the Trayvon Martin case, or I think it's the Jordan Davis case in Florida. But even more than in those particular episodes, we really see it in the way in which our politics is organized. And here's a point I really want to emphasize. When we talk about how pervasive racism is in the society, we're not just talking about how this harms minorities. When we think about how race plays out in our politics, we're talking about how race is being used to hurt all of us, of every race. And this has always been the case, that racism has been used as a tool to distract people from other sorts of issues in which they might have common interest, working conditions in the fields or in mines or in industry. It's very much the case today. Racism is being used to convince people that they need to be afraid of poor minorities, when in fact the power in our society is located in the hands of a plutocracy that increasingly wields that influence not only over the marketplace but over government itself.
Well, what then can the rest of us do to thwart this cynical these cynical politics where the white vote is captured by political candidates who promise to crack down on crime, curb undocumented immigration, protect the heartland against Islamic infiltration. But at the end of the day, it's a bait and switch. What they're really doing is cutting taxes for the rich and giving corporations, free rein and deregulating both industry, environment, and financial markets. At the same time, calling for cuts in what little social safety net we have in our somewhat limited social democracy, Social Security and Medicare.
I think we need to do two things simultaneously. We need to reclaim liberalism, and we need to contest racism. Let me expand a little bit. We understand the sorts of policies that help spread wealth to the vast majority of Americans. They're the policies that we developed during the New Deal era. These policies used to be embraced by Democrats and Republicans alike. They include things like progressive taxation, regulation of industry to protect the marketplace, to protect the environment, to protect workers, the creation of routes of upward mobility, including education, including financing for homes so people can build equity, and investment in infrastructure, government investment in infrastructure to lay the groundwork for the next great economic advance. We understand that those are the policies that we need, but we've stopped defending those policies because the right has been successful in demonizing those policies as handouts for minorities. So we need to, A, recommit to a liberal vision of government in service of everybody, and B, start aggressively talking about how racism is hurting all of us. We will we can expect to encounter more and more race baiting. Liberalism itself has been tarnished, has been darkened, so that the minute you say we need to redouble our efforts with respect to food stamps or welfare or investment in education or in healthcare, we can expect racial attacks. And we need to be prepared to identify them as race baiting, to call them out for what they are and to repudiate them, and to say, we won't let race continue to be used to divide us. And so those two things, reclaim liberalism and also contest this sort of coded racism that passes now for the lingua franca of conservatism.
So you're talking about real solidarity, I mean, and in terms of the left where I am, you know, there is a certain amount of balkanization. How do you basically say that you've got to that we are all being had by the is that what you have to say? We're all being had by the same people, that they're trying to divide and conquer us, and that we have much more in common than we have that separates us, and that we've got to prioritize what we have in common over what separates us. But at the same time, they're not mutually exclusive, right? Is that that?
No. And I'm not sure that this is real solidarity. You know, in an ideal world, if I were an idealist, I would say we should, as a society, come together and take care of the least among us. That would be idealism. That would be to say, hey, we need to focus on the most injured.
Well, that sounds like
that
sounds like the prophet Jesus said that, all of that. You know?
Exactly. That's idealism. This is something different. This is saying, listen, we need to understand who the common enemy is, and we can all work on the issues that afflict us the most. We can all focus on our own priorities. We don't all need to be self-sacrificing or be saintly in that way. But as we work on our own issues, we need to come to realize that most of us face a common enemy, and that is the power of concentrated wealth and the way in which it's now exerting influence over the marketplace and over government. And that it exerts that influence often through culture war terms, not exclusively through race. We should be clear, this isn't only about race, but race is one of the primary weapons. And so to the extent that we want to contest the power of concentrated wealth over the rest of us, we need to be able to respond to its effort to racially divide us. So this is far short of calling for everybody, for example, to become racial justice activists first and foremost. This is just saying to Americans, listen, if you're worried about your kids, if you're worried about your retirement, if you're trying to understand what happened, that the promise of upward mobility seems to have evaporated, focus on the way in which race and other cultural provocations are being used against you, and be prepared to call out and reject that sort of damaging, divisive racial rhetoric.
Well, Ian Haney-Lopez, I thank you so much for your book, Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class.
Absolutely. Looking forward to future conversation.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.